There are a few who have experienced failure to the level I have.
I want to know the truth, but I want to believe in the best.
I had this one track mindset. It was my only job to execute Fyre Festival, and I was going to fund this no matter what it took. This terrible tornado of cash flow. There was just like no separation. Funds were commingled. It was immoral. It was unethical. It was illegal. I was too scared to admit that I needed help. So much wish I can go back to those days before I started telling investors the wrong things. I just asked for help and just told them honestly where we were. If we did that, we probably would not be sitting here right now, and that really hurt me.
What's up, everybody? It's Jamie. You're listening to this podcast because you want to think and you want to live differently. And if you haven't already, the way to get that done as fast as possible is by joining GoBundance at any level. We're the community that you've been searching for with six incredible pillars around contribution, health, relationships, accountability, adventure, horizontal income. Unbelievable pillars that we do everything around in this incredible community. You can experience the power of being in the best physical shape you can be, having a supportive tribe, achieving your bucket list items, having a community of peer partners, giving back and building a lifetime of wealth. So I hope you join us. Join this tribe. Don't sit on the sidelines any longer. As we go into uncertain times, join the tribe where you can find the people and the resources you need to see you through. Go to GoBundance.com. Fill out an application and we'll figure out the right community for you, whether it's Emerge, Elite, Champion, or GoBundance Women's. GoBundance.com. Check it out today. Back to the show. What's going on, everybody? Welcome to the show. Today's guest, Billy McFarland, is known for being the mastermind behind Fyre Festival, a music event intended to take place in the Bahamas, but never did, costing investors and event goers millions of dollars in damages. This story has been documented by Netflix and Hulu in separate specials. And for his role, Billy spent 4 years in federal prison and owes, I believe, $26 million in restitution. Today, he's working on his redemption story by launching his new venture, Pyrte, that's P-Y-R-T, and recently teasing both Firefest 1.5 and Firefest 2.0. Billy, welcome.
Jamie, great to meet you. And I believe you're calling me from the DR. So we'd love to get in if you think that could be a potential destination for Fyre too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We could talk about that for sure. Starting with the documentaries, you haven't watched either of them, correct?
No, I still haven't. And like people try to test me and bring up certain moments and then like they judge my confused reaction to see if I'm lying or not. But I have not watched either one.
Is there an intention to, or are you just like, too painful? What's your feelings on that right now?
So I was like 7 or 8 months into my jail sentence, into a 6-year sentence when they came out. And I purposefully didn't watch it at the time to protect myself from whatever crazy reaction that I know I would have. And I think like it started as self-preservation and it's grown to now like a point of pride where I feel like probably wrongly that I don't want to give credence to it. So kind of ignoring it. But I am just wrapping up filming for the next season of the documentaries. So hopefully we'll have one that, you know, has my full participation in it coming out sometime in the fall.
What does that look like? Netflix, Hulu? Who is that? Who are you doing that with?
It's being filmed by two production companies called Ample and Fremantle. I'm not sure what streaming service is going to air. I think their target date, though, is sometime this fall.
Got it. Okay. Let's get into Fyre. So Fyre Festival, for those that don't know, was meant to be the marketing face or a marketing event to hype up Fyre Media, essentially. So can you talk about that? What was Fyre Media? What was the underlying product that you were selling at that time?
So I've been booking music artists for small concerts for a number of years as a way to essentially bring together my customers from my previous businesses. And throughout all of these bookings, just realized how much the music industry in particular is built on this like smoke and mirrors concept where no one really knows what the real numbers are. No one really knows who the real players are. And as someone with a technology background, this just made no sense to me. So I built a Fyre booking app, and the idea was to allow idiots like me to contact artists directly and make them offers, whether it's for a private concert, for a brand deal, for a social media post, to essentially have technology replace these gatekeepers that I felt like were keeping artists away from their earning potential.
Got it. When you launched Fyre Festival, you were very savvy with influencer marketing, the orange square, the whole thing. I mean, you got a bunch of influencers to kind of put it out there for you. There was a viral video, I'm sure sponsored or you know, paid ads were behind it as well, that really pumped it up. It was a big deal, right, in the social world back in What was this, 2015, I think, if I'm not mistaken?
Yeah, 2016, the video came out.
2016. Yeah. Obviously, what you were promising and I think intending didn't get delivered. When did you realize that? At what point did you know? I mean, if you watch the stuff on Netflix or whatever, there's sort of a people saying, oh my God, we could tell here, but you were still pushing forward. You were, I guess, you know, optimistic, maybe overly entrepreneurial. I don't know. But when did you truly realize, like, oh boy, this is going to be bad?
I actually posted on Twitter literally an hour ago, one of my bank statements from the 28 days leading up to the festival. It's like, this is like the last 4 weeks before the event. And from that one account, spent $12.9 million on the festival. So like up until, wish I had it back now, right? But like up until the last second, I wrongly believed that it was going to happen. And I think like I knew it wasn't going to be to the level of the initial advertisement, but I felt like the island was so beautiful. The people that were coming were inherently like, that was the value, this incredible network of adventurous entrepreneurs. And so I thought that no matter what, we had something great. And it was until the last second when a storm came through, when I thought for the first time, like, wow, I'm fucked.
Got it. The tweet, what was the intent of the tweet that you just put out an hour ago?
So when your bank statement or when your bank account in the US gets frozen, your balance changes to like negative $99 billion. And so someone had tweeted that out, like with the joke saying, oh, here's what happens like when you make coffee at home. And I retweeted it saying like, no, here's what happens when you spend $12.9 million and fire one in the last month. So just like, just shitposting. Yeah.
How did you have the money to spend that much money at the end? I mean, it seemed like months before or weeks before, maybe leading up to it, there was at least an awareness. There was media out there talking about, hey, we don't know that this thing is real. We don't think this can really happen. We're seeing the progress and we can't see how this is going to come to fruition. So how are you being funded? How did you get funding in order to even get to the finish line on this?
So at that point, it was a mix of investors to ticket holders, to consulting deals I was taking on, to event sponsors, to my other businesses, and just kind of became like this terrible tornado of cash flow. And there was just like no separation. Funds were commingled, you know, to the furthest extent of that definition. And it was immoral, it was unethical, it was illegal, and like there's nothing good about it. But I had this one track mindset where it was my only job to execute Fyre Festival, and I was gonna fund this no matter what it took. And obviously I learned there's so much wrong with that thought process, but that was the mentality that was happening at that time.
So were you funding almost real time? Did you have investors having to pay for, you know, accounts payable that you owed real time? Like, were you raising and paying? Like, what did that look like in that last 30 days?
Yeah, we had a 60 day stretch that was awful, where I'd wake up every morning to this Google document that was titled the Urgent Daily Payment Sheet. And literally had like 100K a year full-time employee who all he did was organize all of our invoices and list them in order of priority. And like the least urgent one was like, we're all fucked if we don't pay. Like the most urgent one was like, we're all dead if we don't pay. So it's like, there was always some extreme there. And I'd wake up at 9 a.m. and then have until 2 p.m. to get that cash in the bank so you can wire it out before the 4 o'clock bank deadline. So for, you know, 5 business days a week for what, 12 or 60 days, so like what, 9 weeks there, I was like literally raising money every day. And, you know, so some of those 9 weeks, it was like as little as 50K a day. And some days it was $4 million a day. And like literally had that 2 p.m. deadline every day for 8.5, 9 weeks to raise the cash.
When in retrospect, looking back, what was the point of no return on this festival? Where was it? When was it? If you were to, you know, flash back to that time, when would have been the, okay, this is the time to cut it?
I've gone to one music festival in my entire life before announcing Fyre. So I think like that was probably the biggest red flag. I kind of like looking at it now, I think there's like two ways that are pretty black and white in terms of how business is approached. It's like the haves and the have nots. And when you're a have, you have to be very careful in certain ways. And when you're a have not, you have to take those extra risks to get on base. Then once you're on base, you can't do the crazy shit that someone with nothing can do. And I felt like the video, that marketing trailer, that was like our crazy shit. And the video landed, it worked, it became a real festival, it had real interest. And I should have woken up the next day with X number of tickets sold and been like, okay, I pushed this so far and it actually worked. Let's take a step back, let's get help, let's make the timeline more appropriate. If we'd announced a day later, like, hey guys, we need 6 more months, no one would have cared. But I was like too caught up in the early promises, thinking how to make those come true, that the entire thing unraveled.
Wow. Okay. I'm curious about the, so you mentioned about like, you know, you had this thing, you had a proof of concept, you're ready to roll forward. Were you truly intending to have this festival? Was it something where you were like, you know, no, I want the video. I want that to happen. Or was this I'm going to have this thing. I don't care if it delivers. It doesn't really matter. Kind of like the Woodstock reference, right? Like Woodstock was a mess, but it was still great. So nobody cared. Was your intention to just maximize the income, maximize your income? Or was it truly like, I wanted to have this epic festival the way that it was advertised?
No, it was truly to make this epic festival. And just like literally an hour ago, looking at some of my old bank statements, we spent a couple $100,000 on bug spray. I spent $130,000 on like padding that went underneath the carpet, that went underneath the tents, like things that no one would see or no one would care about. So like clearly the intention at the time was to make this a luxurious experience. And the way that I was justifying it to myself is that I was in a period for a number of years where every month I just kept leveling up at such a rate that today's bills never really mattered. It's like, oh, you know, I need $5,000 today, and like next month I need $50,000. Now I need $500,000. Now I need $5 million. Now I need $50 million. So I kept feeling like yesterday's problems or today's problems will be quickly irrelevant, and that's why I was doing whatever I could to get the money. Like, oh, what's $10 million today? Because after this happens, you know, I'll be a billionaire. Like it was obviously all silly. So I just kept thinking the stakes would keep rising, where it didn't matter what I did today because I'd be able to cover it, you know, once the festival was executed properly.
Got it. I was unclear on, were the tents a promise? Was that even a level of ticketing? Like, hey, your level that you purchased, you're going to get this really nice tent? Or was it all villas and yachts? And then the tents were like, wow, okay, that's a shock. We thought we were all getting some level of like hard building to be in, or the tents something that you actually sold as an option?
We sold tents. I think 60 or 70% of the guests were sold tents. However, we had created a handful of renderings of what we wanted the tents to look like, and the actual tents didn't look anything like the renderings. The tents were not great, but I think in reality, if the storm wasn't there, the tents were actually okay. Like we had brand new furniture inside, brand new beds, brand new mattresses. Like they weren't terrible, and they were actually provided to us by like a real, you know, high-end event company. It was not like the hurricane relief tents that people said online. So no, they were not what we were sold, but the idea always was to house, you know, over half the guests in these tents.
Were there any villas on the island or any boats, yachts for the ultra VIP tickets? Were there actually some there that were built and ready to go?
There were. So there were a ton of boats. And I think what's interesting that hasn't been covered is that a lot of like the who's who of the A-list Hollywood scene showed up on their own yachts without tickets. That was kind of wild. Like, you know, seeing a lot of the big actors who you might know about pulling up on their own boats that they chartered or, you know, got invited to by some billionaire. So that was kind of interesting. But we did have villas. We rented over 200 villas, and we had these physical keys to all these villas. And like due to mismanagement on my end, it all kind of went to shit and just became chaos.
Got it. I have to ask, any of the names that you could share of these celebs or billionaires that pulled up?
Probably not. Like if I ever want to do Fire 2 again, which is obviously part of the plan, I don't want to be in the business of ousting people, but we had quite the crew who was showing up without tickets being sold. And I think that like really proves the underlying concept, right? Like obviously they had zero concern for money and we could have charged whatever it was on the spot. So I think the demand was there and like it truly was close. However, that does not take away from the lies and the fraudulent behavior to raise the money. So I still would have gone to jail. But in terms of like the actual event itself, I did think it was going to happen.
Was the idea, is the narrative on this, hey, you know, we started out with all good intentions. We had a festival we were going to put on. We wanted to make this happen, like you said. And then we breached a point of no return. And it, I don't want to say forced, but it created in me this need I felt to, you know, go the fraudulent route, to lie, to do things below board. Is that the narrative? This was well-intentioned from the start. Everything was done on the up and up from the start. And then later, as it went along, is when, you know, sort of you tripped over this wire that led to the path that you went down.
For sure. And I think, Jamie, what really like hurts me is I think that like immaturity in a certain way powered the immoral behavior that I eventually went down. And I was too scared to admit that I needed help. And I was too scared to admit that things weren't perfect, that I started telling lies to cover those things up feeling like my only way to make people happy was to make this thing work, not realizing that the only way to make people happy and to make this thing work was to admit where I needed help and get that help. And I just like so much wish I can go back to those days before I started telling investors the wrong things and just ask for help and just told them honestly where we were. And if we did that, we probably would not be sitting here right now. And that really hurts me.
All right. On that point, I want to talk about a couple of things that I think I learned were in the pitch deck at the very beginning when you were going to investors to sort of raise for the concept of this. And just talk about these couple of things. One of them I heard was that there was an island that you were given or acquired or whatever it might be, Pablo Escobar's island. That was somewhat covered at a valuation of $8.4 million. And that was part of the investor perspective. It was part of the value offering. Is that true? And obviously that wasn't the case from what I understand. Was that true at the time? Was that about to happen? Or was that a complete lie?
So we had contracts and a number of pieces of like islands and different pieces of land. We were contractually given a piece of land or a handful of lots on an island called Black Point that were valued at $8.4 million. That was real. We did say we bought this island next to Pablo Escobar's island. We had a verbal agreement for it, but we did not buy it. So that was not true. So it was, yeah, basically a mix of truth and a mix of lies at the time, which is obviously totally wrong.
What happened to the $8.4 million island?
It was not a full island. It was like, I think it was three or four lots on this island called Black Point, which is fairly large. And the deal for it, though, was that we had to actually host Fyre Festival there because the person who gave us that land owned a much larger chunk of land and they obviously wanted the attention from it. So I think without executing Fyre on that island, which we ended up moving away from it, voided that contract. But at that time, you know, we were assigned those lots valued at the 8.4 number.
Got it. Why was it moved off of those lots? Why couldn't Fyre happen there?
So we moved islands three times. Initially, it was supposed to be in the Pablo Escobar Island. And I think kind of notoriously, we got kicked off of there after announcing that. And then we moved the planning to this island called Black Point, where we did the deal where Fyre was given or assigned the ownership to these handful of lots. And we just didn't have time to get the logistics done. This is now like 2.5 months before the festival. So we finally moved to Great Exuma, which was the most developed island in the Exuma chain, thinking the island had the water, it had the roads, it had a runway, it had all the assets that we would actually need to get this done in time, but it was just too little too late in the game.
So the three lots were undeveloped, didn't have plumbing, didn't have infrastructure, didn't have anything that you needed in order to pull off the festival. So you had to walk away from essentially an $8.4 million asset to host the festival somewhere else.
And we probably spent $1 million on that island. We dredged out the sandbar, we built a ramp for barges, created like a mile long road. We brought in all this machinery. We started doing a water well. So we started doing a lot of work there. And yeah, actually like a lot of the heavy machinery is still left in the island, but we did lose there.
One other aspect of the investor pitch deck that was, or the prospectus that was out there that has been dubbed a lie was that you owned or maybe Fyre Media, I'm not sure who owned about $2.5 million worth of Facebook stock. And the actuality, at least as reported, was slightly under $1,500 in Facebook stock. Can you speak about that? What was that? Truth, not true, somewhat true.
Yes, this is maybe like 6 weeks before the festival. Needed cash and I totally lied. I called some of my investors and said, hey, can I get the loan against my Facebook stock? And that was wrong. It wasn't true.
Got it. So you asked for a loan against $2.5 million in Facebook stock?
I'm not sure what the exact number was, but yeah, I was lying. Whether it was $2 million or $3 million, I don't recall. But I told them I had more Facebook stock than I did by a long shot.
Got it. Okay. I want to go through kind of the arrest and then the imprisonment and talk a little bit about that. So you were arrested and released, I believe, on $300,000 bail. And at that point, it was said that you were broke, moving in with your parents. But there was this story about maybe you starting another business with a guy named Frank Tribble, NYC VIP Access, or at least he was the face of NYC VIP Access, which was selling exclusive, adventures or whatever to the Grammys or meeting celebrities or baseball games or whatever it might be. Was that a real business? Like what people paid for, would they get what was being advertised or was that all just to try to recoup some losses that you had?
Yeah, I think there's obviously a lot of media cycles around that bail period. Some were not true and some certainly were true. A number of months before I got arrested again, so maybe like 6 or 7 months into bail, I was like so desperate to try to get money. And I thought in my head, like I have to pay these people back or else I'm going to jail. And it's like, it's so silly. And it's like, still don't understand to this day, but got in over my skis, started selling tickets and thinking I could pull things off like I did before. And I think what started as a great area, intentions quickly crossed the line and became terrible intentions. And I was arrested for it. And I think in all reality, probably added a number of years since. So it was just like so incredibly stupid.
What happened to Frank Tribble? Do you know?
Oh, I have no idea.
He's gone off the mat. Like, just was he part of, was he arrested? Was he put in jail or no?
No, he was never a really big part of my life. And I think I missed a lot of the media narrative because I got arrested as all like news stories are being told. So I think I missed a lot of this, but I think he worked for me for like maybe 2 months. So not sure the exact time period. Yeah.
The video in the documentaries is extremely, I don't know, wide open, man. Like it's wow. Like it's very, very behind the scenes. How did people get access to that? Did you sell the rights to this media? How did Netflix, Hulu get this? Like they have you the narrative in the documentary. And you said it before, like people are trying to, you know, bring you back into the documentary, but it's something people are familiar with. But the narrative is, yeah, you're out on $300K bail and you have no money. And yet you have this penthouse living high on the hog with this guy, Frank Tribble, selling fake tickets. Where does this documentation come from? How did they get their hands on it? Was this something that you were able to sell or did they just have it?
So I certainly was not behaving correctly at this point. I think the documentary is completely like exaggerating the narrative and it's pretty easy to twist the footage that way. I had a personal videographer that I had hired individually and I was basically filming things myself. And after I got arrested, without me knowing, he essentially kept copies of all of like my day-to-day life footage and resold it again to the documentary producers.
What, when you say it's exaggerated, like I can believe that. Reality TV isn't real. Even HGTV's shows where you think people are looking at three houses, like that ain't real. So set the record straight. I mean, I know you haven't seen the documentary, but it sounds like you have some awareness of what the narrative is that's being painted specifically post-arrest, pre-sentencing. What is, from your perspective, the real story?
It's like, okay, we sold 6 tickets to the Grammys. Fuck, guys, let's go figure out a way to make these real. And, you know, I'd be running up and down the streets of Manhattan, like going to all the artists I know, going to the brokers I know, getting the tickets, trying to distribute it, coming up one short or two over, like missing the mark here, missing the mark there. So it was more like a mad race to fulfill what we had sold. It was never like, hey, guys, like, let's get them. Like, let's steal $1,000. Like, so I think if that was a narrative, that was certainly false. However, the true narrative is like me being a complete moron, getting it over my skis and just not understanding reality.
Got it. Okay. Last thing on this, the penthouse that you were in, how did you pay for that?
I'm not sure what penthouse it was in the
post-arrest after bail. The narrative again was that you had this opulent penthouse that you were living in. And that's where this video footage of you and Frank doing business on NYC VIP access was being taken place. And the folks talking about it indicated that somehow you were paying for this. Set the record straight if I'm wrong on that.
Yeah. So I guess I was living in an apartment prior to Fyre Festival. And just because the festival failed, like my landlord didn't kick me out the next day. So I was there for, you know, another half a year, if not more, after the festival failed, probably more than another 8 or 9 months after the festival failed.
Got it. Makes sense. You did 4 years in federal prison. I don't care so much about the, you know, what's it like in prison, but for you specifically, what was prison to you? What happened for you in prison, to you in prison? Talk about just the progression of your 4 years. Who were you going in? Who did you maybe become? Who did you come out as?
I think it was the forced time out that's the hardest part for me. And I feel like any entrepreneur listening right now could really resonate to that, where we are so used to this concept that we are going to make or break our future by our actions today. And then when you get to jail, you realize that anything you do can only hurt you more. And you literally need to sit down and shut up for a number of years. And that was just so hard for me to comprehend and come to terms with.
Yeah. Entrepreneurship, man. Like when you look at again, in the documentary, I'm watching this and I believe in second chances. I believe in, you know, people being able to reform themselves. I believe in the idea of, you know, you can go down a slippery path. I mean, we're all a decision or two away from doing something really good or doing something really bad. But when you think about what you were dubbed as or what your mindset was, as just purely, if we use the word entrepreneur, right? Big thinker, you know, get it done no matter what, right? These are terms that we associate with Elon Musk, with a lot of entrepreneurs, right? So So for you, it seems like you've got entrepreneurial tendencies, and I've had a few folks on like you that have taken those entrepreneurial tendencies and unfortunately applied them in a way that got them in trouble. One guy, Michael Santos, did 29 years in prison as a Coke lord. I mean, great entrepreneur, bad industry, right? Kind of thing. So, but he's come out, he's reformed himself. He's done a lot of things that have helped the prison community, to be honest with you. So it is interesting. Like you said, any entrepreneur can relate. It's full transparency. Getting on this call or getting on this podcast, for me, it's a little bit of like, okay, I want to know the truth, but I want to believe in the best, right? Because I see and hear the entrepreneurial tendencies that you have. And then we'll talk in a little bit about what you're doing going forward and how you're going to restore trust in that. But it is an interesting parallel how entrepreneurship can slip the other way. I don't know if you have any comments on that. I can just move on, but I'll just drop that and see if you have anything to say.
One thing that's really interesting, and then I don't know, we all kind of grow up being taught there are good guys and there are bad guys, right? And like having a very black and white view in the world. And I was certainly guilty of that for the first 24 years of my life. And then when I get to jail, I'm like, oh, wait, maybe 5% of the people here are actually bad. And the other 95% aren't. They're just somewhere on the spectrum that the rest of us are on, right? We have good, we have bad. And based on circumstance, based on exposure, based on emotions, we make decisions that place us somewhere on the spectrum. So I truly think that a very small percentage of the overall population are actually bad people. And the rest aren't able to control the impulse or their emotions in a time of stress or need and do something truly wrong that labels them as a bad guy. But unfortunately, the world is just not that black and white.
When you see on like Wikipedia, first thing that they say on Wikipedia about you is fraudster. Pull up any article and you know that phrase comes up, the you know fraudulent fraudster, whatever the case may be. How do you handle that day to day?
Yeah. And like, I think I totally ignore it right now, and it's probably wrong. It's just like, it's so hard. And, you know, I don't know. I wanted to say like trier, right? Like I want to be someone who just like keeps trying to make something happen. I think like that is more indicative of what I've been searching for, like kind of searching for freedom, searching for fulfillment, searching to make my own impact in the world. But yeah, it's just crazy. And I think what's like really interesting too is how quick and eager people who don't know me are to talk down. And I think it's kind of sad. And I've like noticed this behavior against others, and not just me, is that I think we're just like very quick as a species to want to justify our own decisions and our own actions and to justify our own unhappiness by saying, oh, well, at least I'm not a fraudster like him, right? Like I might be chronically depressed. You know, my spouse might not like me. My kids might hate me, but at least he didn't do this. So F him, he sucks. And I think it's kind of like where we're trending right now as a society is the need to put others down to justify our own, you know, lack of fulfillment.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, even you think about when somebody dies early, we always are looking for that, right? Like, oh my God, they were 38. How'd they die? And then you hear, oh, you know, they were morbidly obese. Like, oh, okay. So I'm okay because I'm not that. Like I have a
exactly.
It's that healthy individual with like, oh my God, they were healthy. They would eat clean. They would do this, that, and the other. And they just, you know, stroke and died at 40 years old. We struggle with it. Like, no. They had to have done something wrong. They had to have done something bad. They were a smoker or they were taking some sort of supplement, something so that I could feel good about the fact that, okay, that won't happen to me. Right. So there's a lot of truth in that.
Yeah. That's very, very true. Yeah. We're very quick to, whether it's like find a victim for a problem or find a rationale, like very few people are able to admit their true strengths and weaknesses and good decisions and bad decisions. So we often try to find external explanations for what's happening to us.
In prison, you did an interview with a former guest on this show, a guy I've talked to, Jordan Harbinger. And I believe, tell me if I'm wrong, you were committed to solitary after having done that interview. Talk me through that decision. Were you aware of that? You know, why do that interview? Maybe let's start with that. Why do that interview from jail?
I've had nightmares for the past 2 weeks about this. And it's like, I think like this is the longest lasting effect that I've had from jail, where I am so guilty going to jail, like mentally understand why I'm there. I deserve to be there. I get in trouble initially in jail. I clearly break the rules. I understand why I'm in trouble. And now I do this podcast and I get sent to solitary. they are telling me I'm never going to get out, that I'm going to be in there forever, just like messing with my head, and end up doing 7 months in solitary for this podcast. And while it was certainly stupid, it didn't break any rules. Like, you're allowed to talk to reporters over the phone. People make music over the phone. People do TV in jail. People do podcasts every day in the phone over jail. And like, I shouldn't have done it, but it still wasn't a clear violation of the rules. And I just like have this trauma where it's like someone can snap their fingers and lock you in a 9x8 concrete box for the rest of your life just because they want to. And that just scares the shit out of me.
Why shouldn't you have done it?
I think like trying to cause attention to myself, my situation while in prison was, you know, like that's against what you're really supposed to be doing. So like it's against like the code of jail, but it wasn't like a clear violation of any specific rule.
What was your intention then? You said call attention to yourself. For what reason? What do you recall? Like, what were you thinking would be the benefit of calling attention to yourself while in jail?
I basically signed to this podcast production company, and they were in my ear that we would be able to make this a highly profitable podcast, and that I could use it to pay restitution, that I can pay people back, that I can, you know, fund my commissary account, blah, blah, blah. And so I thought it would be a great way to prove that I was still a capable business person. And they were obviously pushing me to like say as much as I could and do as much as I can, because they would reap the rewards as well. And the intentions there were to try to like show that I could still do something.
How long into your sentence did this all happen, the podcast and then the solitary?
I was like 2 years in.
About halfway?
Yeah, halfway through.
What
yeah.
Was there any benefit to solitary? I know it's an odd question, but is there anything that you're thankful for with solitary confinement?
So I did two stints in solitary. I did a 3 month stint and a 7 month stint. I think the 3 month stint was the best thing to ever happen to me in my life. And it sounds cliche, but it was truly, truly like incredible looking back. And I think like there's just so many lessons learned during that time. But it just like came down to one moment where there was a guy with a 38-year sentence. He was in solitary for 3 years at this point. And, you know, he looked crazy. He tattooed his face and his lips to look like a tiger. And they call him the White Tiger. And like, if you saw this guy in the street, you would run away. But then you start to see like the human side to him, where he's not screaming and crying because he's trying to kill you. He's like screaming and crying because he just like needs human attention. And I wrote a letter to a friend, and they sent him like a $4 magazine 1 week. And like literally this guy was on cloud nine for a month. It's like a $4 present to this guy, like completely changed his mindset. He started thanking everybody and like cleaning his cell, like being the nicest guy in there. And all he needed was the attention. And like that, like I just didn't know how to handle that. It's like, wow, like the fact that you can send a guy a single magazine and someone who literally deformed their body to look like a tiger now just becomes like the nicest person in the world. And that was like a really, really crazy experience. And super glad I got that experience. But then the next time with the 7 months, I feel like there's a barrier of how long you can spend alone in those circumstances and still be like a normal person. And I don't think I crossed that barrier, but I think I got pretty close. And I just like feel bad for the guys that are in there for 5, 6, 7, 8 years in solitary. Because if I did that, I would not come out as normal.
Yeah, most of us probably wouldn't. And look, solitude is a good thing. It can be. Tomorrow I'm doing what I call a solo weekend. I just check into a hotel for 3 days by myself, you know, kind of journal out and think through things without all the noise of life. And
by
3 months or 7 months, that's a little intense. What was the 3 month solitary for? Do you recall?
I was trying to write a book, and I had a USB device that I was like transcribing the book onto. So I think what was ironic about that was a clear violation of the rules. So like I go to solitary, I understand it. Like I'm an idiot. I fucked up. I'm going to serve my punishment. And I got that. And I feel like that was actually helpful for me. I didn't hurt anybody by breaking the rules, but I still broke the rules. So deserved the punishment. But the next time where I didn't really break any rules and I was there for longer in a worse circumstance, like that really messed with my head.
On the topic of trust, I want to dive into this a little bit. So let's just start with the easy question. How do you overcome? And we're going to talk about Fire 1-5, Fire 2. How do you overcome the reputation, the history, all of what you have right now in order to gain the trust of investors, employees, people that you're around? How do you, I don't know, what do you say to somebody?
It just takes time. And I think so many of my past problems came from trying to get things done too quickly. And I just cannot do that again in any circumstance. And people always ask me, like, what do I feel most guilty about? And it's like the person or the group of people that backed me since I was 19 years old. So when I called them 5 years later saying, guys, like Fire is going to be bigger. I promise. I need more money. Like, this is it. And they were in no position to question me at that point. Like, those are the people that I would have trouble looking in the eye right now. And my goal, and I think like what really motivates me is like, can I shake their hand one day? And it's like I built back and like, sure, that's financially. I don't really think they care as much about the money. I think it's more like as a human, like I have grown and, you know, I've come a long way. And like, that's something that I want to prove to them.
Have any of them reached out? Any of those people that you're identifying that maybe were around from the beginning, or do you have any of them in your life right now, or are they all sort of keeping their distance?
People have started to reach out. It definitely took longer than I thought. My sentence ended on August 30th. So I'm like 8, 9 months in now. I kind of expected that I would walk out of jail and have the support system like there to greet me. And the reality was it was my parents who came to pick me up in like Detroit, Michigan at jail. And they gave me some like shitty wallet with $200 in 20s in it, dropped me off at the halfway house and basically said, good luck. Don't spend it all in one place. So really like started with nothing. And it took a handful of months to break through. And I think I'm at the point where every week now someone from like the old life is reaching out. But I think a lot of the people who were really hurt the most in terms of trust just haven't gotten there yet. And I understand it. And like, I have a lot to prove before that can start happening.
What are they reaching out for? Is it potentially to invest, or is it more, hey, we see you, you know, we appreciate that you're trying to do something. Like, what's the conversation that most of these folks are reaching out to have with you?
I think it all varies. Like, some just like want to know, like, some are on the human level, like what's going on? Like, are you okay? Like, why did you do this to me? Here's where I am now. And like, I think those are the conversations that I really need the most. Unfortunately, as I've started working and like making very small steps towards progress, a lot of people are reaching out like, hey, where's my fucking money? So it's something like a mixed bag of people across the board. And I'm actually like less, there's like a smaller pit in my stomach for the guys who are owed money, because like, I know I'm going to work my ass off and pay everything back financially at some point in my life. The deeper hole that I have are the ones that I hurt like emotionally and like hurt their relationship that they invested so much time in. And those people can't get back the 5 years that they opened their hearts to me rather than someone who like invested at the last second. So while they're both wrong, I feel like filling that emotional hole is the tougher challenge for me.
You owe $26 million in restitution. Is that accurate?
I think so, yes. Yeah, whether it's 26 or 25 or 27, I'm around that, yes.
It's a lot. Is it the same amount? Like, have you been able to, I don't know what the arrangement looks like for something like that. Have you been able to pay down any of that, or is it still out there? And what is the arrangement that you, I don't know, what is the, how do you have to pay that back? Is it like, just pay it back before you die, or they're going to garnish your wages forever? Like, is any of it paid down, and how do you pay it?
Yeah. So like, wages are essentially garnished forever. A percentage of all my income, whether it's a TV show, a marketing consulting job, a movie, a festival, whatever, a percentage of all that income gets paid back to the restitution. And it's just like a percentage of whatever my take home is. I pay every 3 to 4 weeks, and I've paid every 3 to 4 weeks since August 30th. I paid like 40K so far. So I know it's like a small number, but you know, I have to start somewhere, and it'll grow over time.
Who is owed restitution? Is it credit card companies? Is it party goers? Is it investors? All of it?
That's a good question. So the restitution are the technical victims of the crime. And while there were a lot of people who were hurt by what I did wrong, I was charged for lying to investors. So the restitution is just the investors. There's another group of people that I really care about, which were people who are working for Fire who are still owed. A significant percentage of that are people who live and work in the Bahamas, for example. So that's a totally separate bucket, and you know, working on efforts in addition to the restitution efforts to pay those people back as well.
Okay. I want to talk about Andy King for a minute. The guy's fascinating to me. So you were working with him. He was a partner, let's say, on Fire. And for those who maybe saw the documentary, and you know, this is well covered. This was the guy who, when the Bahamian government was holding up water to Firefest for like $175,000, your statement to him, something thereabouts, was, I need you to take one for the team. He's a gay man. And you wanted him to essentially go blow the head of customs, right? That was the deal. And he was going to go do it. That's what he said at least on the video. What's interesting is, so when you left prison, or shortly thereafter, there was an article in The Pedestrian where he says, the title is Billy McFarland out of jail, asking for money again and being roasted by Andy King. He even remixed a TikTok reel or TikTok of yours, you know, kind of like, I don't know, what's the word I'm looking for here? Like, I can't think of the word. What do you say? Like trolling you a little bit, I guess, in that regard. And as recently as February 1st, there was an article in the U.S. Sun where he is saying, hey, Billy's never apologized to me. I think he's going too fast, too soon. Here we go again. It all feels like the first time. But not a month later, in early March, you two were collaborating on a reel talking about, you know, running it back. Firefest 2, Firefest 1.5. Talk to me about that flip. Like, what's happening with Andy King and you, where it goes from him trolling you and saying in the media, like, he hasn't apologized, nothing's been done right, I'm afraid of this guy, da 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 da, to now, you know, you guys are talking about doing something together again. What happened there?
So I'm a big, big fan, supporter, and friend of Andy. I truly don't read articles that come out about me, so I just wasn't unaware of his comments to the media. I'll give him a call after, though, and give him some shit. But yeah, he tried his best to execute fire, and he did, you know, obviously went above and beyond. I think the story was certainly exaggerated. I never ordered him to go blow some guy for water. I think it makes for great TV, though. But Andy did bust his ass and, like, gave everything he could to make fire reality, and certainly let him down there. And whatever reincarnation of fire happens next, whether it's a musical or something else, Andy will certainly be involved to the extent at which I'm invited to be involved. So my next projects, I'm, you know, staying away from all the logistics, and certainly I'm not giving the latitude to actually execute a Broadway musical. That is a totally expert third party, and I can kind of help with the marketing. But to whatever the extent my role is, Andy will be there alongside of me, and, you know, hopefully we can turn this into a positive event, a positive experience.
I got to ask this question. So set the record straight on that then. In the documentary, Andy himself is saying, I was asked to take one for the team. I went home. I couldn't believe it. I put in mouthwash. I was getting ready to go. And the guy was thankfully very kind and said, yeah, I'll release it. You just got to pay me money. He didn't have to perform any acts. But you're saying that wasn't necessarily what you asked him to do. So set that straight for me. What was the real story from your perspective?
So I asked him for the first time, I don't know, maybe like 2 or 3 months ago, like, what actually happened? And he said that, and I believe he did this on a podcast, he said that someone called him saying, Billy wants you to go blow the guy and get the water. So I think it was a game of telephone. And I'm sure had I asked, Andy would have taken one for the team, and he certainly would have lived up to his hype and beyond. But no, yeah, I think it was a good moment for TV, and probably a message that got exaggerated across the wire a little bit.
Got it. Let's talk about Pyrt. What is that exactly? PYRT. What is this project that you're working on?
So basically spending my time doing 3 things. One is media stuff. So wrapping up filming a TV show, essentially like the next version of the doc of Fire. Other part of my time is doing a lot of marketing consulting work. And that's Pyrt. So Pyrt's main job right now is like my marketing creative agency, where we essentially help a lot of venture-backed startups break through the noise, get attention, engage celebrities and influencers, and find viral ways to launch their product. And the third angle is everything Fire, whether that's a Broadway musical, a movie, the next act of Fire 2, just like working with potential partners to make all those dreams a reality.
What's the timeline on some of these projects? What's the timeline on Fire 1.5, the Broadway musical?
Yeah, so behind the scenes, we've been working on Fire, like the next version of Fire as a Broadway musical. I think it's like a really incredible idea where it combines a music concert with the storyline and the dreaming and all the themes of hustling and like leveling up and trying to bring people together into like one format, which I think is really, really cool. So I did a tweet essentially teasing the Fire Broadway musical, and this 2-sentence tweet created a massive media storm. And the interest that we got from that storm was absolutely insane. And this brought a number of partners who came to us and were like, wait, what kind of moment can we create if we pay back your restitution and in exchange for that, get the rights to actually host and execute Fire 2 according to the original vision? So this went from a Broadway play to a Broadway play plus a couple of these massive partners who we're speaking with now to see who wants to actually execute Fire 2. I will not be involved in the logistics. Like, I'm not a music festival guy, but I will certainly help with the marketing and help with the storyline behind any of these projects.
You're raising from investors for these projects, and I think you had said, you know, the raise is directly correlated to paying your restitution, paying back the people in the Bahamas as well as your restitution. What's the value proposition to the investor beyond that? So essentially, if you're saying somebody invests $100,000 in Fire Fest 2, the show or whatever it is, that's going to go toward restitution. Is that what I'm hearing? Is that the investors get back? They get to be at Fire Fest 2, but all the money goes to restitution?
No. So I'm not the one raising capital for any of these projects. There are third parties, like whether it's the Broadway company, whether it's a nation or a festival company, they're in charge of all the financing and actually executing the event. I'm basically charging marketing and licensing fees. So if you want like the rights to my life, or if you want me to market this project for you, then that's what I'm getting hired to do. So, you know, I'm being hired and partnering with these people, but they're the ones ultimately responsible for funding these projects. And obviously, like, the draw of Fire to a nation is so incredible. If you could bring 3,000 to 5,000 of the most followed people in the world to one destination for a weekend, the media coverage you would get is absolutely insane. And I think once you compare that against other concepts, whether it's a golf tour, a big international music festival that these countries are currently investing in, the returns from Fire are, you know, pretty on par, if not more, in terms of the overall reach and attention.
Are you going to be able to attend Fire too if it's out of the country?
I don't know. I truly don't know. So we'll see. But I think, like, you know, once the restitution is paid, I'm hopefully in a more lenient position to be able to travel. So knock on wood.
What's a timeline that you're hoping for that's realistic for you to repay the restitution based on what you're seeing that you're able to generate?
I'm in no rush. Like, I think it would be nice to have a location picked out and, you know, partnerships announced at some point in the next few months, but there truly is no rush. And I'm not the one raising money. I'm not the one actually executing things. So I'll let the big boys work and, you know, focus on what I'm good at, which is bringing people together, creating an adventure and marketing these projects. So when it happens, and I hope for the people who are owed and for my sake as well, sooner rather than later. But I'm just like taking my time and going down this path.
So the Fire 2, are you expecting that this franchise, if you will, the projects you're working on now, are you expecting that those combined projects completely pay your restitution?
I think there's been opportunities where this is a possibility. Like, it has not happened yet. So like once it happens, I'll come back here and talk about it. But once again, it's taking our time. The musical will likely happen first. That's not going to pay back the restitution in full. It's a good step, but it's not, you know, not going to make me $26 million. I think the interest in the musical spawned this whole Fire 2 concept, where partners came in and said, hey, how much reach, how much attention, how many impressions would we get if we did this? And that started the dialogue around the paying off the restitution.
So just to be clear, Fire Festival 2, whenever, wherever that is, what is the fingerprint of Billy McFarland on Fire Festival 2, if any?
I like to think I'll have a say. I like to think that I could, you know, provide the adventure. I think I could provide the storyline and I can do the marketing. I think at the end of the day, the demand for Fire 2 is absolutely insane. I actually got some stats the other day that since 2016, there, just on Facebook and Twitter alone, there have been 37 billion impressions seen by over 2 billion people about Fire. So like the brand awareness is like absolutely incredible. And this like far exceeds some major sports leagues, a lot of the major productions that we all know about. And after like announcing that Fire 2 is in the works, we've had thousands of people ask to attend. I had 500 people actually email me asking to invest. We're not raising from those investors, but just like to show the overall demand there, I think is super, super high. And I think the draw for these new partners is if they could be the one to come in and actually execute it properly, you'll have one of the biggest festival brands in the world. If they were not part of the issues before, which they weren't, and they come in and do it correctly, I think that's just like a massive storyline and a massive win. And this is going to be covered by the major streaming companies. It likely will become a major, you know, feature film. There's going to be a Broadway musical. So I think there's a lot of attention and underlying value to the Fire 2 brand, as well as the concept of bringing together different people through adventure.
What is your, just so I know, are you the CEO of Fire Media or Fire? What's the business structure for Fire Festival 2? Or is it a standalone festival, its own entity, just that one festival? It sounds like it'll be a series of festivals or a festival brand. So what's your role? What's the business? What's that company?
Yeah, I think I'm unlikely to have an operational role in the entity that's actually like executing the festival. And then obviously that's up to the partners who are actually executing it to determine. So just like not able to speak on any of that yet.
Got it. Okay. So you talked earlier, and I think that, you know, look, this is a show about a podcast about, you know, a community of guys, and, you know, we have our women's side as well. You know, making sure that we're surrounding ourselves with the right people. So earlier you said, you know, hey, I wasn't around the types of people that could pull off this event, and now I'm getting around those folks. Can you talk a little bit about that, the importance of your community, what you're doing there, how intentional you're being? Just sort of dive into, you know, who you're surrounding yourself with and how you feel like that is going to, you know, prevent anything repeating itself from Fire One.
So what's actually really interesting is I've had probably 50 to 60 of the old Magnesis members who have become invaluable resources since I've gotten out of jail. And they were the ones who were around for the peak of that community. So I think, like, what is cool is that whatever I am allowed to do to help with the Fire musical or Fire 2 is doing it alongside a group of people who really want to build. And I think that I was just like taking off more than I can chew and trying to do a lot of it myself before. So this time around, it's like, one, finding the best partners, which I just didn't have last time. But in two, it's creating a community around this. So I think Pirate will eventually morph to this community of people who are all around the table or helping me through these projects, whether it's marketing for a Broadway show, marketing for a hotel somewhere, marketing for Fire 2, marketing for a venture-backed business, but really all about just like finding a great group of people and building with them, because we are just like up against so much. This is going to be quite like the monumental task in front of us.
What happens if this gets fucked up to you? What's the consequence for you given the history? Do you know? Do you have any sense?
Sure. I think like there are a few who have experienced failure to the level I have, and that means a lot to me. And I think it starts with the approach. Like, how are you going about things? And if I am operating honestly and I go for it and I fail honestly, that is something I can still find fulfillment through. I think the alternative approach is like try to do nothing. And I just like can't find pride in that approach. So I'd rather go for it. I'm certainly going to take my time and I'm not going to do anything crazy tomorrow or next month, but go for it honestly, focus on my skill set, get the best help in the world. And luckily, the brand just has so much reach and so much attention that we're able to find, you know, the industry's best people to help us make all this a reality.
If somebody out there is listening, I was just on the topic of branding. I mean, it's almost like the old adage of like, no press is bad press, right? But what's the lesson that you've, like you said, yes, there's a ton of impressions, a ton of awareness of the Fire brand, billions of impressions and so many eyes that have viewed it. But, you know, generally speaking, it's in the worst light. But to your point, if there's enough interest out there for you to say, wow, you know what, I can, you know, I think no one would discredit your ability to kind of read the market and say, okay, I can see where this has value and potential. What's the lesson for somebody that's maybe building a brand, building their personal brand, wondering how to monetize their brand or whatever it might be? I don't know what you might extract or teach from that.
Yeah, you can't buy culture. And I think Fire Festival 1 has become part of pop culture. And no matter what happens at Fire 2, good or bad, it's going to go down in history. So I think brands really need to understand like what they're paying for when they're marketing. And if you can make your brand have a permanent legacy on culture, you have a huge business in your hands.
If this hits, pay back your restitution, all of that stuff, are the consequences of the culture you've built, will you think it was worth it?
I don't think so, because I think there are people who are harmed along the way that can never be, they can't get that time back, whether it's someone who invested, someone who believed in me, someone who worked so hard. I took that away from them, but I can't focus on that, right? Like, you can like get lost in analysis of fear and just like, and die a slow death. Or you can say, listen, I messed up. I can never make that totally okay, but I hopefully have 50 years left in this world. And like, let's make those 50 years as productive and as fulfilling as possible.
Billy, people want to reach out, or not even reach out, but learn more about what you're doing, follow you, see what's going on, you know, kind of intrigued by what's the next move for Billy McFarland. What's the best place for them to go? Website, social, whatever it might be.
Follow me on socials at Pirate Billy, P-Y-R-T Billy, and look out for the next doc in the fall. I've not watched the last ones, but hopefully this one gives everybody better insight into what it's actually like to get out of jail, start with $200 and 20s in an old wallet and nothing else, and mean streets of Brooklyn.
Beautiful, man. Appreciate you coming on. Thanks for telling your story. Thanks for being so open and transparent and taking the questions, man. So thanks for doing this.
Jamie, thank you.